Just towards the end of that very fine take one.
Yes.
You mentioned Timothy Spall.
Yes.
And that reminded me.
The great Timothy Spall. To give him his full name.
Who I spoke to when he was in the film Denial, where he played the...
David Irving.
David Irving, the Holocaust denying, in quotes, historian.
Oh, yes.
And there's...
On a previous incarnation of this show, you interviewed Tim Spall about that film, didn't you? Yes.
Yes, that's right. And... there was some social media conversation. I'm only passing this on because you're not on social. Well, you are on it, but you're not on it. About reports that David Irving had died. Anyway, so then there's this woman called Dinah Rose who on Twitter says, talking about the case, which, if you remember, David Irving brought himself.
Yes, he sued.
He sued Penguin and Deborah Lipstadt. Okay, so in terms of mistakes to make, I have never heard of a bigger one than this, a more costly one than this, okay?
Okay.
Dinah Rose says, if I can get this to... My husband was in court watching the libel trial Irving disastrously pursued against Penguin and Deborah Lipstadt.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he represented himself in court, didn't he?
That's right.
Never a good move.
And in the movie Denial... That's what you see now.
Yes, yes.
In my memory of the film, I don't think they included this exchange because it would have appeared totally unbelievable.
Okay.
But this is the eyewitness account. Dinah Rose, my husband was in court watching the libel trial when in one of the greatest Freudian slips of all time, David Irving accidentally addressed the judge as Mein Führer.
No. In the real world.
Now, if that was
in the real world, not in the film.
Because if that was in the film, I can't remember if it is in the film, but you go, no one is going to be that stupid. But David Irving, Holocaust denier, far rightist, called the judge Mein Führer. I mean,
wow.
No wonder he lost. Gary Fitzpatrick.
My mind is blown. No,
exactly. Gary Fitzpatrick, who's in Sydney, second time emergency mailer, gold medal in the County Sligo Community Games, Art and Crafts 5 years in a row.
Yes.
Following on from your recent review of True Detective, Night Country.
Yes.
And the ensuing mention of the Dyatlov Pass incident. This is the 1959 unsolved deaths in the Soviet Union story, which we alluded to.
Yeah.
I'm sure you both will be interested to know the nearly 70-year mystery may have had a cinema-adjacent solution.
Right.
Despite the many possible theories over the years, animal attacks, group hysteria, secret Soviet weapons testing, Sasquatch, and so on, the prevalent cause was always thought to be somehow avalanche-related. Johann Gaum, I've almost certainly got that name wrong, Johann Gaum, head of the brilliantly titled Swiss Snow Avalanche Simulation Laboratory, was so impressed with the realistic snow movements and flurries from 2012's Frozen, that he actually met with the animators at Disney to talk about the technology and coding they used to create it. Gaum and his research team then used the same code to help analyze the weather conditions at the time of the incident, and lo and behold, they concluded that small but forceful avalanche known as a microburst could be enough to create the kind of blunt force trauma injuries suffered by the victims at Dyatlov Pass. According to their research, an avalanche of that size and power in very specific conditions could do things like break ribs or cause serious head injuries or even enough soft tissue damage to result in death, unlike most avalanche victims who tend to die of asphyxiation. Lovely, says Gary. Tinkity Tonkin, down with tacky sneaker hawking fraudsters. I just got to the end of True Detective Night Country. And full respect to the team who wrote that for keeping the reveal for like the last 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. Quite an astonishing piece of work and very well acted.
And let's not spoil it for anyone who's...
I'm not. But it's all shot in Iceland and it's not in Alaska.
It's good though, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Very good.
Yes.
As I said, I still haven't seen any of the other True Detective series, but this is completely disconnected.
So. Andrew says, I was listening to you last week. I was surprised to hear reference to the Golden Square Nordic Bakery.
Yes.
Where I worked for a few months as a barista. And Andrea is Cheers from Edinburgh via Mexico, she says. I just graduated from Goldsmith College because you had to be an artist to land a gig there. Go figure. Being a barista was super boring, so I asked the owner if I could move to the kitchen. I used to make those famous cinnamon buns and loved it until one day one of my artist colleagues finished her shift, had a flower party with me, and in the kitchen left me to deal with the aftermath. The Finnish manager...
Is it a flower party as in F-L-O-U-R? As in flower.
F-L-O-U-R. U-R. Yes,
so
exactly.
Throwing
right.
flour around. Okay, fine.
The Finnish manager, who looked like a character straight out of a Karismäki film, Finnish film director, obviously, saw the mess, told me off, and the next day I was a barista again. Anyway, it bored me to tears, so I left. One of the things I most remember, and I apologise if I've got this pronunciation wrong, is that F.A. Cackerell used to go there every day. He is the founder and CEO of Mubi, who we talk about a lot.
Wow.
So this is decades ago. So the guy who set up Mubi used to go
to the Nordic Bakery on Golden Square.
I ate a lot of those huge cinnamon buns then, and I still miss them. You know, so...
They're really buntastic.
F.A. Cackerell is Turkish.
Okay.
And Turkey, so the biggest exporter of TV shows... America, Britain, Turkey, number three.
Isn't wow.
It? Yes, exactly. Just thought I'd mention that.
In wow.
Another thing that I learned from The Economist, who still don't sponsor this particular podcast. Tell us about a movie we could go and see.
Well, let me just ask you on a pronunciation thing.
Okay.
So you were just saying there, Mexico came up in that. The name M-I-C-H-E-L, how would you pronounce that in Spanish?
M-I-C-H-E-L.
Michael?
Spanish, me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Michael.
If you give it a little kind of...
Okay, fine.
Yeah, you can probably get away with...
Great. So this Memory, which is a drama written and directed by a Mexican filmmaker, Michael Franco. Did I do that okay?
Passed.
Who did After Lucia, Chronic, and Sundown. This premiered Venice last year, where Peter Sarsgaard won the Volpi Cup for Best Actor. Jessica Chastain, who is nominated Best Performer at the Independent Spirit Awards, which I believe are this weekend, is Sylvia, a social worker working in an adult daycare center who is also a recovering alcoholic. She is 13 years sober. She looks after her daughter. She goes to her AA meetings. She has a fairly ordered life. She meets Saul, who's the central character, by Sarsgaard, who sits, she goes to a high school reunion, which she doesn't want to go to. She goes there with her sister, Olivia, who played by Merritt Weaver, who was so brilliant in Unbelievable, which we saw on television recently. And she goes to the reunion, and at one point, suddenly this bloke comes up and sits next to her, Saul, and looks at her and smiles at her. And just sits next to her, so she's a bit creeped out. She gets up, she walks off. She leaves, he leaves. She walks home. He follows her home. She goes into her house. She looks out of the window and she sees him there standing outside her house. The next morning, when she opens her door, she finds him asleep and obviously something is very wrong in the street outside. So she goes through his jacket. She's trying to get a response out of him, but he's not responding. She goes through his jacket. She finds a phone number. She rings up his family and she discovers from them that he has early onset dementia. So he doesn't know exactly what's going on. And she then goes to visit them and to see if he's okay. Is that why she's going to visit? And then they go for a walk in the park. And during the walk in the park, remembering that he followed her home from a high school reunion party, he says he can remember things from the past. He can remember his childhood. He can remember his wife, who he has lost. But he can't remember her. Here's a clip.
Now you remember me?
No.
Well, I guess people change after many years.
But we didn't go to school together.
Oh, I remember. You really don't remember me?
No.
You remember Ben Goldberg?
Yeah, we went to high school together.
Yeah. He used to get me drunk after school. I was 12, he was 17.
And that story then proceeds in a really alarming way. That's a story of abuse, in which she remembers him being involved in. He doesn't remember. He says he has no memory of it. I mean, he said that he remembers his childhood. He said that he remembers, you know, things about school. He remembers this person that she's talking about. But he says he has no memory of it. And she says to him, you know what? You deserve being the way you are. And she walks off. Then, and I don't want to give too much of the plot away because it's the plot has many twists and turns. She ends up going back to see him and going back into her own past. And the film becomes a conversation about who remembers what, who is misremembering, and who, and whether or not people are attributing one thing that happened to another person. It turns out her dates aren't what she thought they were. It turns out that she has a very, very, completely disenfranchised relationship with a mum, played by Jessica Harper, who has in the past thought that she was just, you know, a terrible, wayward kid. Her mother describes her as somebody who was uncontrollable as a child, who went out and got drunk, who would come back and tell stories that she would make up, stories that weren't true. And it becomes apparent that there is a whole twisted history in this story. And as that happens, these two characters who we saw there on that bench get to know each other and get to find out things about each other. And it becomes a story of two people battling the demons of the past. His loss of memory, her alcoholism, which she has now overcome, but the clear PTSD that came from something that's happened in her past. And it becomes a kind of discussion about quite complicated issues. How much are we defined by the past? How much is the present defined by the past? How much is the future defined by everything that has gone before? And at the center of it are two people who are doubted by those around them to have the ability to define their own present. Now, if that sounds pretentious, it's partly because I'm trying not to just simply sit here and tell you the whole story, but also because the performances, and I think you could see it just in that scene, are very, very nuanced. It's not a film of big, shouty revelations. It's a film of small engagements and small nuances. White A Shade of Pale plays throughout it. And it's an interesting thing because that song has different associations for different people. And I know some people just think, you know, White A Shade of Pale, oh yeah, it's the song that is played every, you know, every other minute on every other radio station. But it is there's something very, very haunting about that song that works particularly well in this context. And I think the film has got an odd cumulative power, and it is large. I mean, it's interesting, of course, that the awards consideration was absolutely for the performances, and you can understand why. I think you interviewed Jessica Chastain about, was it the film when she was the financial?
Yes, I did. Talk to her about that.
Which one. I think was up for some BAFTAs. I can't remember the name of it now, but she's really smart. I mean, she's a really, really smart actor. And seeing the two of them together, both playing characters who are wrestling with the demons of the past, whether it's because those demons are present, or whether it's because those demons are absent, and the fact that nobody else in the drama takes either of them at their word, or allows either of them to define their own lives, I think is what the drama is about. I would also say that it is a drama. You were talking before about trigger warnings We were talking about trigger warnings in an interview that we recorded today, but that won't go out until later on.
An
interesting thing. So it touches on some very, very dark subjects, but it is also at its heart a film about two people, both of whom in strange ways have got similar issues with the relationship between the past and the present and the future, and the fact that they are defined by everyone around them as unable to define their own presence. Which, as I said, makes it sound pretentious, but it isn't. Because of the way the performances work, it's actually a drama about two people. And I found it surprisingly engaging because at the beginning, I didn't know where it was going. I didn't know anything about it at all. And I was genuinely feeling my way through the story because I did not know where it was going.
The conversation about trigger warnings is a conversation with Cate Blanchett, who will be on the show soon.
We have interviewed Cate Blanchett. She was fabulous, wasn't she?
Always.
Look forward to that because she is great.
She is always fantastic. Correspondence at kermanamayo.com. Yep. Let's do a plot smash first of all.
Okay. So I thought we'd run out of time.
I think...
No, we haven't run out of time. We're going to do Plot Smash. Thank you, Simon Paul, for not rushing to my aid.
So...
I like this feature so much.
If you get three films on the first sentence, you get 5 stars. Second sentence, 3 stars. 3 sentences, you get 1 star. There will be no question of us getting that far.
Mm-hmm.
No films, no stars.
Did you see what they posted on social media last week? They posted 3 pictures of me trying to figure out Plot Smash, and it said, a triptych of anguish.
Yeah, that's probably quite fair.
It's a very unflattering photograph, incidentally.
Okay, so you got 13 stars out of 30, so it's 43% at the moment. I think you're going to do very well with this one.
Don't do that.
Play the Carpenter-esque tension.
Say goodbye to love.
Which 3 films have I plot smashed here? A high school girl who is pressured into dating so that her sister can also have a boyfriend becomes pregnant and decides to put her unborn child up for adoption, Juno. All under the watchful eye of an unorthodox yet inspirational new English teacher.
Okay, so one of them is Juno, and the inspirational English teacher could be the Dead Poets Society.
It could be.
All right, so I'm going for Juno and Dead Poets Society.
Okay, that's 2.
Yeah, so I have got 2.
You have got 2.
Right, fine.
Second sentence. In a cave near the school's American football pitch, a group of boys and girls read poetry, smoke pipes, and play and dance around to I Love You Baby on the saxophone.
Do it again.
I haven't finished it yet. And the girl finds out the prospective parents of her unborn child are separating through a conversation on her burger phone.
Yeah, I don't need the... So the burger... Yeah, okay, fine. Just do the beginning bit again.
In a cave near the school's American football
pitch. In a cave near the school's American football pitch.
A group of boys and girls read poetry, smoke pipes, and play and dance around to I Love You Baby on the saxophone.
In a cave near the school's American football pitch. A cave.
I think the cave is in Dead Poets Society. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fine. Okay, so...
So you've already got that.
I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, I've forgotten the cave. Okay, so once more with feeling.
Which bit?
The whole thing. Because I thought was thinking that was from a different
The cave near the school's American football pitch. A group of boys and girls read poetry, smoke pipes, and play and dance around to I Love You Baby on the saxophone. Girl finds out the prospective parents of her unborn child are separating through a conversation on her burger phone.
Yeah, no, I've still got the same 2, and I can't figure out what the 3rd one is.
At prom the following week, Juno finds out that her new boyfriend was actually paid to take her there and runs out distraught.
Oh, Carrie! No. Yeah, okay, go on. Was actually paid to take her
Juno
there.
Juno finds out her new boyfriend was actually paid to take her there and runs out distraught. Inspired by their eccentric English teacher, everyone stands on their chairs
and says, Captain, my captain. Okay. So somebody was paid to take somebody to the thing. And yet, of course, it turns out that they are really in... Oh, fruitcaking poppycock.
Police constable, how many stars are we going to... Because you're not going to get this one.
I've got 2 of them on the first one, but the last one... So somebody is paid to take somebody on a date. They are paid to do it. Yes,
The answer is 10 things I hate about you.
10 things I hate about you.
How many stars? 2 stars, is that? 2 stars?
No, it's no stars, because I didn't get it even on the 3rd go. No stars.
No stars. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Daniel Marcus in Luxembourg. The other day we sat down with our...
I don't care.
Okay. Sorry, Daniel.
Wait, I do care. Come back.
The other day we sat down with our 2 boys, Philip 9 and Alex 11.
Philip 9, that's funny.
To watch Blazing Saddles, shown on the BBC to mark its 50th anniversary.
Oh, yes.
The lads have seen quite a bit of screen violence and generally scary stuff and been totally unfazed by it. But the opening sequence of Blazing Saddles, in which the black railroad workers are abused by their white, in quotes, masters, left Alex and Philip, aged 9 and 11, feeling genuinely upset. They got the point that this was the setup and that baddies were going to be bad, but they hadn't been confronted with this kind of badness before. Sheer cruelty and racism with copious use of the N-word, in short, unvarnished taboos. I told them that these awful people would get their comeuppance during the film and that they'd be shown up for the idiots that they were. I also assured them that cinema's most famous fart scene was just around the corner. Thankfully, the comedy rolled in and the tension was lifted.
I hadn't seen the movie since I was a kid, and some of the scenes even gave me a jolt, like when the horse is thumped and crumples to the floor. I'm not sure that what young me made of that back in the day, but I have an awful feeling I found it so outlandish I burst out laughing. In short, it was a wild ride watching this outrageous film in 2024. Alex and Philip had certainly never seen a film in which the protagonists of a film set 100 years in the past go to a modern cinema in costume and buy tickets to watch the ending of their own movie. And the Count Basie scene is such a joy, even if you don't know who Count Basie was. Anyway, keep up the work. We've said this before, especially if it's a comedy.
Yes.
It will be, there will be some scenes there which you get, that you can't do that.
Yes. Although I think that one can agree that Mel Brooks's intentions are good. Because one of the things that happens with Blazing Saddles is it is a film about racism. And in order to be, and it, what it does is that it makes a lot of jokes about the way in which the characters who are racist speak. And there is one of the sort of central jokes in it is when basically it's Cleveland is the black sheriff who arrives in this town where they are absolutely all completely horrible to him, and he then becomes friends with the Waco kid played by Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman, played by Gene Wilder, played by Gene Hackman, would have been a very different film. And there is a scene in it in which Gene Hackman says, after he's been called all these names and these terrible words that we can no longer say for very good reason, Gene Wilder's character, the Waco kid, says to him, "Look, the thing is, these are honest people. They're poor people. These are uneducated people. Salt of the earth, you know. Morons."
There you go. That's a classic. Classic Mel Brooks line. I interviewed Mel Brooks once, and he is genuinely incredible to be so sharp. And he's
112, isn't he?
I mean, he's genuinely not far off. Remember that fantastic time when he was on The One Show? He's looking completely baffled, as one does when one's a guest on The One Show. And they've gone from talking about his film to, something very serious. And he just says, "This show is nuts." And all the other guests on the sofa, they go, "Yep." You just needed Mel Brooks to point that out. One Frame Back.
One Frame Back.
Inspired by Madame Web. And we're asking for your suggestions for films about clairvoyance.
Who is clairvoyance?
Tyron says, Sam Raimi's The Gift is an overlooked gem.
Actually, it is an overlooked
the
gem.
The best is easily Ghost. Whoopi was wonderful and suitably fake too. Mae Yam says, Don't Look Now. If you're not afraid of little children in red coats, you haven't seen it. Floyd Dillon is suggesting The Changeling in 1980 with George
Good
C.
Scott, film.
An
Good
underrated
film.
Paranormal film.
Yeah.
And Emma O'Cleary, The Dead Zone, probably the best Stephen King adaptation with Christopher Walken's best performance. In fact, I was thinking of The Dead Zone when you were talking about the Web film.
Yeah, Madam Web.
Where you touches someone and gets what's going to happen in the future, which is what is so terrifying about The Dead Zone. The whole setup about that is finding this megalomaniac who then wants to become president. Yeah. I mean, imagine.
I know. Imagine if that was the case, that could happen.
The Dead Zone coming back this year.
The thing that was said about the Dead Zone at the time was, if The Shining is a Stephen King film for people who don't like Stephen King, then The Dead Zone is a Stephen King film by David Cronenberg for people who don't like Stephen King or David Cronenberg.
Oh, okay, that works.
And David Cronenberg himself said, it's the one when little old ladies come up to him at the end and say, "I don't like your movies, but I like that one with Christopher Walken in it."
Christopher Walken is very good at
that. He's great, yeah. Really, really good. If I'm going to choose any of them, it has to be Don't Look Now, which recently celebrated its 50th anniversary, is still one of the greatest films ever made. Nick Rogue was a genius, but so much of Nick Rogue's films are about time not being what it seems. He's constantly shifting time frames, and Don't Look Now is kind of the most acute demonstration of that. And of course, the gag, and it is a gag. If you look at the short story of Don't Look Now, which is written by Daphne Du Maurier, it begins with the phrase, "Don't look now, but I think someone's trying to hypnotize us." And it ends with the line, and as his lifeblood was flowing away, all he could think was, "What a bloody silly way to die." And it is a Shaggy Dog story, the gag being that the person who is clairvoyant doesn't believe in clairvoyance, and the person who isn't clairvoyant does believe in clairvoyance, and that's what causes the tragedy.
And that's your choice.
That is my choice.
That's the one you're going for.
Yeah.
On the weekend watch list this week, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, mm-hmm. which is worth mentioning because the late Alan Freeman is in there,
Fluff.
Along with Roy Castle and so on. Wild Rose on Film 4, The Nightingale on Film 4, The Red Shoes on BBC Two, Quo Vadis Aida on BBC Four.
Which is an astonishing film.
Cat Ashworth, As the Nightingale was the last film I saw at the pictures before lockdown. Won't be that. I'll go for Wild Rose. Mark will choose either The Red Shoes or Quo Vadis Aida. Neil Boyce, has to be Red Shoes. Time rushes by, love rushes by, life rushes by, but The Red Shoes go on. Darren Mackay, if The Red Shoes hadn't been on that list, it would have been Dr. Terror, without a doubt. And Floyd Dillon, a fantastic anthology movie with the great Peter Cushing as Dr. Shrek with his pack of spooky tarot cards. That's the Dr. Terror movie. What would be your one to particularly look out for?
It's disappointing that nobody's picked up on The Nightingale, which is the Jennifer Kent film, which was very, very, very overlooked. When it first played in festivals, people walked out because they thought it was too tough. But the reason it's tough is because it is a tough story. I am going to go for The Nightingale because I think of all of those, it's the one that hasn't been celebrated. Quo Vadis Aida, which is Yasmila Osmanic's film, which is absolutely brilliant, but it was in contention for sort of major awards a couple of years ago. The Nightingale, people still forget about, and Jennifer Kent is a really, really important and fine filmmaker. So although it's a tough watch, and we were mentioning before trigger warnings, it is a very tough watch. It is really worth seeking out.
Okay, and that's on Film 4 Saturday at 1:15 in the morning.
So set your recording device.
Put your VHS in and span the barcode and everything will be fine.
Yes.
Stuff to avoid on our not list, Independence Day Resurgence, Doolittle and Mutiny on the Buses. Emily Lind says, a reminder that the climax of Doolittle is Robert Downey Jr. shoving his arm up a dragon's bottom. A thing that when I read a review prior to seeing the film, I was sure must be a gag on the reviewer's part. How wrong I was. Mm-hmm. Gary Clark says, of all the films with terrible accents, I'm looking at you, Don Cheadle, for Ocean's 11, and you, Jared Leto,
God,
for
blimey.
Literally everything, but especially House of Gucci. Doolittle is a crime against accents.
It is.
And Ben Buckley says, Mutiny on the Buses is a far more fulfilling movie experience than Independence Day Resurgence. But it's a choice of three. What am I going to avoid the most?
I'm going to go for Doolittle. I've said this before, not just because of the crime against the Welsh accent, but because of the fact that in that film, Robert Downey Jr. does a Welsh accent in the same space, in the same room, as Michael Sheen, who is Welsh.
I wonder if Michael had a word.
He did. I asked him about it. I asked him, how was it? And he said, it was what it was. There was nothing you could do about it. He had decided that he was doing it, and that was the end of that.
Anyway, RDJ is doing fine.
RDJ is doing very, very fine, thanks to Oppenheimer, in which he does not use a Welsh accent.
You remember last week we had an email about a three-year-old with curly hair throwing popcorn at the screen.
I do, and that was how they overcame the baddie, wasn't it?
That's right.
Was during migration. Was it migration?
No, it was it was the whale film.
The whale film.
Free Willy. That's what it was. So threw popcorn at the screen against the bad characters, and then everyone gave a round of
applause. That's right, yeah, when Free Willy was finally free.
Well, this email pops into our inbox.
Okay.
From Charlie. Just a follow-up from my brother David's email. It's me, the three-year-old curly-haired killer whale saviour, with just a few points. So this is the curly-haired three-year-old.
Okay, this is the other point of view, Your Honour.
First point, this retelling brought to light the origin story for a lot of my adult life's problems, the main one being, to my wife Loredana's lament, I still sit in the aisle seat at the cinema for fear of having to shuffle my 6-foot, 7-inch frame and curly mop out of the screening for toilet breaks.
Very good. I feel the same way.
This is particularly hard in a packed Peckhamplex on a Saturday night. The back row with a clear line of sight to the door is my safe space.
Yes.
Second point, our mum
Remember, they had like 1,000 kids. Must have been sleeping throughout, as the only thing she took from this immersive family experience was the idea that we liked looking at trapped sea life, and subsequently took the whole family to SeaWorld in Florida years later. Sadly, this time I couldn't free Willie. And the third point is, this anecdote has served me well throughout my life. Perhaps it was actually the pinnacle. I used it as my UCAS application for my film degree, no doubt bringing laughter to the university lecturers, much like the chuckling from Mark throughout last week. I have loved Mark for years and have seen him, a few times about London, but have been too starstruck to say hi. I mean, you must have noticed a 6'7" curly-haired
guy throwing popcorn at a whale.
I have stood next to him awkwardly on the tube and even chickened out from asking him to stop to talk about my charity when I was street fundraising. Who said the magic of cinema is gone when on a cold February morning, I randomly hear my earliest memory drawing a laugh from one of the people who first inspired me to get into film? One last point before anyone judges. Maybe popcorn wasn't the ideal cinema snack to chuck at Willie, but when it comes to saving on-screen animals, it's often the only thing to hand.
That's right.
And I imagine cheesy nachos would not have drawn as many high fives and affection from the rest of the audience. No, indeed. In terms of chucking food at the screen.
Yes. At least popcorn would just bounce straight off.
That and minstrels.
Oh, yes, minstrels,
Minstrels would also have worked, yeah. I suppose.
Because they have the coating, which means they melt in your mouth, not in your hands.
I think that was treats. But it's
the same principle.
It's the same. It is exactly the same principle. Anyway, Charlie, thank you. So, Mark, next time you see a 6'7" curly
Leo Sayer lookalike,
yes, then you could say, "Here,
oi,
you're Charlie, the guy who threw popcorn at the whale."
And then just some completely random 6-footer with curly hair will go, "What?
Go away.
I don't want whatever you're buying, selling."
correspondence@cobodemeo.com. Thank you very much, Steve, for listening. Your questions and schmestions will be with you on Wednesday. If there's anything that you've felt moved to ask, whether it be cinematically related or whether it's just about, you know, life, because Mark and I know so much.
So much.
We're so wise.
So much.
Very, very wise. Even our kids... No, our kids don't. even our... No, our parents don't.
Can you not... Child 3 saved this show.
Child 3 did save this show.
By the miracle of waking up.
Yes, and handing over the laptop to the courier.
Do you think he had to go and lie down afterwards?
He's almost certainly back asleep, even as we speak. Thank you very much, indeed, for downloading us. Questions, schmessions with you on Wednesday.